I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Marion McKinnon Crook is the author of Always on Call, Adventures in Nursing, Ranching, and Rural Life. It was published this past spring and has remained on the bestsellers list since. It's a sequel to Always Pack a Candle, and their marvelous insights into the life of a public health nurse in rural British Columbia in the 1970s. Marion joins me now to talk about the book and about what it was like for her and her family in the Cariboo, a vast rural territory that quickly becomes home to her husband, Carl, their three young children, and the many farm animals they have. It's not without its challenges, as we read in the book, as Marion also has to oversee a small staff of rural public health nurses. She encounters runaway patients, needle-phobic hockey players, and stories of abuse and neglect. It's also the 1970s, and we see some social progress, especially for women. Marion McKinnon Crook is a nurse, educator, and author of over 25 books. Along with her nursing degree, she has a master's in liberal arts and a PhD in education. She's also the author of the British Book Tour Mystery Series under the name of Emma Dakin. Visit MarionCrookAuthor.com for more. The book is published by Heritage House. We taped this interview in mid-June 2024 with Marion joining me from Gibson's, British Columbia. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Marion McKinnon Crook. Dr. Crook, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. As I told you just before we started, how much I enjoyed the book a great deal. You're a marvelous storyteller. Was that something that you were always endowed with, even as a young person, say?
I would say so. My family read stories a lot. My dad used to read them at night. There was a lot of kids. And we used to gather around, sit around and listen to Burgess bedtime stories and all kinds of stories. And we had children's books and knowledge, and we had lots of books around. My parents would buy books for us. And I remember being criticized on my report cards that I daydreamed a lot in class. So when I was in elementary school, I just really daydreamed, think up stories. And, they used to have us read stories in elementary school where every child would read a paragraph. And
sure.
Then you knew when your time was coming. And I found that so tedious. I'd finish reading a story before it got to my turn, and I wouldn't know where they were because I'd been reading ahead. I was always fascinated with stories.
So most of this book takes place in the mid-1970s. And one would wonder how you remembered everything. Did you have a writing practice, say, at the time? Because you were also very busy keeping house and maintaining your job. How did you remember everything? Did you keep a journal, say?
I didn't keep a journal. The interesting thing about memory is if you keep a journal, apparently you pair off details that you don't put down, so you don't remember them. But every time you think of, I didn't, but I had a capability of remembering incidents with all the dialogue that went with that incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought everybody did that, but I learned that, no, everybody doesn't do that. And so they just stayed in my mind. I can't really explain it, but I do remember quite well. I forget a lot, too, like a lot of people do, and I forget tons of things, but I do remember some things very clearly, but no, I didn't write them down. I don't think I wrote them down. I probably wrote like little journal entries every once in a while, like if I was angry about something and didn't want to talk about it, I'd write it down. If I was trying to make up a decision or something, I'd sometimes write it down. But I didn't find those. If I have them, they're someplace buried in my basement.
Yeah.
I don't have them, but I probably did write down something.
So
I didn't consult them.
Yeah. So as the book starts, you're in the midst of working in the Cariboo. I haven't read the first book, the previous book to this. Just to fill in the story for people listening, you studied nursing at the University of Seattle. Is that right?
Yeah, Seattle University. I graduated from there and came to the Cariboo as my first job.
Yeah.
In 1963, and the first book called Pack a Candle talks about when I first came to the Cariboo. It was such a culture shock to get off the bus and see this place. And I was naive, as you'd be, at 21. And I had this vast territory to go through. And so that book is my first year at in Williams Lake, where I was based, and out in the country around it. And Always on Call, this book, is set in mid-70s, 75, 76, when I married and had three children and was still working public health and involved, and we had a ranch, and we're involved in all the work of the ranch and the kids and the nursing. And it had changed somewhat, but I still had a big territory to cover.
We're hearing in the news a lot about these challenges in rural hospitals, especially in British Columbia, you know, emergency rooms closing and the sort, because of a shortage of doctors and nurses. It just seems to me that these challenges were always there, especially in rural parts of this province, in the 60s, in the 1970s. Was that the case as well?
Not so much nursing shortages or doctor shortages, so much as shortage of specialists. Mm. We didn't have any specialists.
I see.
We had one. Actually, we had an internist in the 80s, I think. We had our late 70s and 80s, we had an internist. But we didn't have and we had a pediatrician for a long time. We had a few specialists, but not a lot. So people had to go out of town to Kamloops or Prince George for care a lot of the time. But no, they didn't. I did work hospital after public health for a while, about a year and a half. And I worked casual relief, so I'd come on call when they needed somebody. But there were nurses around. I don't remember there being a shortage of nurses.
Yeah.
They did try and, well, there was a very young population in the Cariboo at that time. Like, there was a logging industry and ranching and all the service industries that went with the logging industry. The mine started up soon. So there were a lot of young people attracted, and a lot of those young people had partners who were nurses and teachers. And so that, I think, is why we didn't have such a shortage then.
Yeah.
Now the Cariboo is more diverse in demographically, so you're not gaining that influx of young people the way we had in those days. That may be why. I may be totally wrong. I'm not a specialist in that, but I don't recall there being a shortage.
Yeah, that makes sense, that what you just said, because, you know, the population that was there when you were there are probably aging. And then you have an influx of new people that are there, you know, doing the service jobs and the sort. The demographics have changed 50 years hence. You must get the question a lot, whether it's this book or the previous book, as to why you ended up there. Because you could have worked anywhere you wanted, I'd assume.
That's true. And I really think that one of the reasons was I read too much Zane Grey, you know. It seems like a very romantic place to go.
Yeah.
I my plan was to go there for 2 years, then go up north, and at some point get my master's degree and go up north and end up in the Arctic. That was my plan, because you could be really independent up there. And that was my plan, but I didn't move out of the Cariboo for 20 years.
That's one of the you mentioned your master's. That's one of the lessons you got at Seattle University, was once you graduated there, that was just a start, that you always kept on learning. And that's a marvelous lesson, isn't it?
Yeah, they were very emphatic about that, and that you had to learn. And you always had to learn. And it's true, like, nursing changed so much, you know, that I taught nursing for the last part of my career. I taught nursing at Cortland here in the Fraser Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And you learned that if you tried teaching facts to nurses when they first came in, those facts would have changed by the time they graduate. So you actually had to teach them how to look for the facts and how to check the facts and how to test the facts. and not just accept them. So it was a different way of teaching and learning, you know, all that time. But back in the day, why did I come? Well, I wanted to practice nursing, and I wanted to do it as far away from the czar as possible. You know, with as much independence as I could get. And, sort of being gray, maybe.
Yeah. Do you get a chance to go back to the Caribou today?
Yeah, I was there in May. Uh-huh. Yeah, just a month ago. Not even a month ago, I guess. Yeah. And I did a book signing there, and so much fun. So many people came, and people I knew from the old days, and people didn't know. And nurses, young nurses came. They're excited. It was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does it look like today as opposed to, say, the Caribou that we see in the book? It's changed a great deal, obviously. Does it still seem familiar to you?
It doesn't look much different to me.
Really?
Not much different to me. Not really. Not the town. I know it's bigger, much bigger. But it's spread out, and you don't see that, the increase in population, increase in houses and that when you first go into the town. So it looked much the same as it did when I left it in the 86. But it looks quite a bit different than it did when I arrived, because then it was really town, you know, and much more sophisticated now. But it doesn't look much different from when I left. And the people, I still meet people that I knew then, so it was fun, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess we talked about this just a few moments ago. You know, there's a population ages and it, you know, diversifies and it gets bigger, obviously. The challenges that sort of society has in terms of health care, those change too, don't they?
They do, and last time I was there, I met, some nurses came to my signing, and one of them said, "I'm the director of mental health nurses for the area," and I looked at her and I said, "There are mental health nurses?" Because we had to do everything, right?
It
would have been so wonderful to have mental health. We had mental health nurses for the hospital, but not in the public health area, so that was a change, and then she introduced me to her friend. She said, "She's a street nurse." Oh, man, that's what we did, too. There wasn't any designated street nurse. Everybody took part of the town and we tried to look after the people, right?
Yeah.
So I was impressed with that. So I think, and I also think that specialists and I went there for a signing for a pack of candles, and I was in the hotel, and I wanted to get to the town, which was a little ways away, and I was snowing, and I didn't want to walk it, and I called for a taxi, and I got the answering machine that said there are no taxis available today, and that was the only taxi service in town. So I went to the breakfast at the hotel, and I stood up and said, "Is anybody going to town?" And I got a ride with an optometrist who was visiting. So he's a specialist. Like, he was a specialist coming to town to stay for a few days and work in the optometry office there. And I thought that was a good solution. He drove a Porsche, too, which was really helpful. And I thought that was a good answer to some of the health problems they would be. So you're sort of alert to that things have changed, you know. You used to have to go out to the specialist, and now they're having some come in.
Yeah. You didn't drive a Porsche back then. It was a Suburban, right?
Yeah, it was a Suburban.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a big family, three kids, a husband.
Yeah.
And then you had this farm. What sort of animals did you have?
Well, we had 80 head of cattle, and we had... We had 26 sheep. That was my job. I didn't do it very well. We had chickens. We had goats. At different times, we have calves at different times. We had pigs. Certainly had pigs. My daughter had pigs. We had ducks at one point.
Yeah.
There'd be ducks in the house at one point. We had roosters in the house at one point. We had... I can't remember. I think that's about it. Nothing exotic, just, you know, farm animals.
So it was obviously a very busy day for you every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then not to mention the children and the family. How do you avoid burnout, especially in a job like nursing? I mean, as I said, they're busy days and nights. How did you, because it seems that you managed your time well.
Well, I had friends, a lot of friends, so I had conversations and coffee, you know, with friends, so there's debriefing, and nurses were really, colleagues were really supportive of one another. It was a wonderful collegiate atmosphere to work in, so that makes your work a lot easier. And I had, and I read, like whenever I could, I read detective novels, and I read escape literature, and I read biographies, and I read all kinds of things. I read a lot. And we went on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was and I was young and energetic, like honestly, I had a guy working in my house yesterday, and he's really, really busy. I looked at his order book, like where he's going, and he's like every minute is stuff full, but he goes on vacations too, and he leaves an answering on his answering machine is, I won't be back for 2 weeks.
Mm.
Luck. You know, you have to schedule those things or you go crazy.
Yeah. There is a vacation that you and Carl took to Vancouver one weekend.
Oh, yeah.
which is an exciting story because you attempted to fly here.
Yeah.
Yourself, taking a Canucks game and then the opera. Those sort of adventures, were those regular occurrences? Like a couple times a year, say? Or?
Oh, yeah, there were regular occurrences that we would fly, but not regular occurrences that we would have so much trouble. But, we had a plane, so we would fly lots of places. One year we flew to Tuktoyaktuk, mm-hmm. And the same year we flew to Yuma. So we got around on that plane. We flew. It was like an 8-hour drive to go from our place to Vancouver, uh-huh. and like 10 hours to Victoria. And it's an hour and a half flight for us. So we did fly.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you can come back to work the next day, and I'm going to avoid talking about that story because it's an exciting story, as one reads in the book, and people listening to should look forward to that. What was the relationship like with other professionals, say in healthcare, doctors especially? Did you experience sort of the condescension that say a nurse would experience with someone who was a doctor, say?
Not so much. I found most of the doctors very cooperative and very willing to use my expertise in my area to help their patients. Mm. Right? And I would do the same. Like I'm not a doctor. I don't do your thing. But they're not a public health nurse, so they don't do my thing. And so I had lots of really good relationships. In fact, when I was there in May, one of the doctors came in and said, "You don't remember me? I'm so-and-so." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I do." But I didn't recognize him, but I remembered him from the past. And he was a doctor I worked with. He said, "I want to buy the book to see if I'm in it." I said, "No, you're not. You're not bad enough to be in it." He went, "Yeah, I got along fine with you." Yeah, there were lots of really good doctors, but you tend to remember the ones that gave you bad time. There was still condescension, but it was changing, and it changed quite a lot. It was changing at the time I was working in nursing. You could feel it changing, and the new doctors that were coming had a much more cooperative attitude than some of the older ones who would cooperate with you, but they didn't understand your job so much as the new ones did. But they were a bit of everything.
Yeah, you did encounter prejudice, you witnessed it, and you tell a couple stories in the book about that. This is something that my mom experienced she was a nurse for many years, where you would say be caring for a patient and a patient wouldn't want a particular, say even doctor or nurse of a particular ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do in circumstances like that, and especially if you're in charge, Marion? How do you talk to the patient? Say.
Well, if you read that bill where I did get that, he either gets the nurse I give him or he doesn't get any, and I had the ability to do that. So I just didn't tolerate it, actually. That's sort of my bottom line. That's not a reason for anything. So if you weren't getting the care you thought you should get, that's another issue. We'll talk about that. But you just don't like the color of the nurse's skin, too bad.
Yeah. You're particularly attentive to that because two of your sons have indigenous heritage. And, just one, pardon me. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that in the book about you talk about learning about that, especially, which I found quite interesting, especially in that era.
Yeah, I wasn't aware. I really wasn't aware. Well, I would be someone who participated in the 60s scoop. So that, you know, my son was one of those. And we didn't even think about that we were doing anything wrong. Like, it never crossed our mind. So we had a big learning curve to get through. And nor did I think that other people would be prejudiced against my son. Well, why would they be? Like, you know, and they were.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, you had to, and I started to recognize it. I started it when I came there in 63. I started to see the division in the town that I had never expected to see. And so I was aware that there was prejudice, but I didn't expect to find it in, you know, he's still there when my son was born. I expected it to be gone, and I was wrong about that. It's still there.
Yeah. And you mentioned just a second ago about the access to healthcare and getting the healthcare that one needed. Did that prejudice, say, preclude someone getting the help that they needed, say?
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah. There's a story in the book about a fellow who had burned himself quite badly. A person of who was homeless, I think. And
he had a home, but it was a tent.
I see.
Yeah.
And so he needed his dressings to be changed regularly.
Yeah.
And he also drank quite a bit, which scared a lot of the other nurses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess, would that be a situation where if you weren't around, he wouldn't get the help that he needed, say?
No, he would have gotten it. They wouldn't have not given him the help. No, they were just reluctant, right? I don't think that they wouldn't have worked for me for long if they did that.
Mm.
But I don't think they would have. I don't think in the health unit anybody would have been denied health. Never saw it. In the health unit, I never saw anyone denied because they were Native.
Yeah.
That was not in the health unit, but I did see it other places. I didn't see it in front of me in denied health care, but I expected it to happen when I didn't see it.
Yeah.
But I saw prejudice in other areas. So I guess I can't answer that too well. In my bailiwick, when I was supervising the healthcare nurses, there was no way that would happen.
Yeah, and you in the book talk about this particular patient. When he drank, he was quite violent, and you told him
he's just scary.
Yeah, he was scared. He was scared. Yeah, and so you told him, you know. Just don't come here drunk, and I think he did. He showed up not drunk, right?
Oh, you know, I don't. I just said if you're drinking, don't come.
Hmm,
you know, I didn't.
Right.
I didn't accuse him of being drunk. I just said if you're drinking, don't come. And he said, okay, so that's the deal. That was the deal.
Yeah. You also tell stories in the book of abuse and neglect, and a lot of these stories do stay with you, don't they? I mean, they're quite vivid all these years later.
You
mentioned a moment ago, if it's bad, you probably remember it more, don't you?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. What, I was going to naively, because I've lived in Vancouver my whole life. I was born here in the sort. I was going to naively suggest that those stories are, but those stories are universal, aren't they? Whether you live in a city or a rural area, right?
Oh, I don't know. There's a thought. That's interesting. I suppose they've got to appeal to the universality of our experience, I guess. Because otherwise people wouldn't understand the story, right? So
yeah.
I suppose that's true. Yeah, could be. I was going to think about the things you remember, though. I understand that you remember something if it's tied to emotions.
Mm.
And you remember it if it has consequences. If you forget it, it has consequences, like your phone number or your car keys. You have to have... If there are consequences, you probably remember it more likely to remember it. There was a couple of other reasons why you remember things. Four of them, I forget now.
Yeah.
And in the Caribou, in nursing, all four of those reasons to remember were pertinent to me.
Yeah.
So that's probably why I remember things.
Yeah, they're memorable people that you write about in the book. I mean, they're characters that I remember. Having finished the book for a while now, that I still remember as I'm talking to you, that I'd like to ask you about, but I probably would give away some of the stories, the marvelous stories. The book ends, Marion, with you thinking about getting your master's degree at SFU, which you did pursue, as well as a PhD. So there's much life that you lived after this book ends. I'm wondering, will there be other books?
Well, the problem is I can't make up the incidents, right? They have to happen. So it's not very entertaining. Well, I can't talk about students, and I taught nursing for quite a while. So that doesn't seem like a good book. But I have this idea to write a biography, so I'm getting really fired up about it.
Oh, I see.
So I'll write more books for sure.
Yeah, the marvelous stories that you do tell. The other thing I was wondering about was people around you who are in not just Always on Call, but the first book, who are depicted in these books. What have they made of what you've written about?
Well, I do change names.
Sure.
And in some cases, particularly that one doctor that I had so much trouble with, I changed him pretty well so he wouldn't be recognizable, because I didn't want to get sued. And any lawyer I dealt with, I changed a lot too. So and also people that didn't come out looking too great, I changed them so you wouldn't know who they were. But some of the characters in there, people do recognize them. And they're quite affectionate toward them.
Yeah.
Because I treat them like I like them. So it shows. A lot of them from the first book are no longer with us. But in the second book, a lot are. And they're happy to be named. You know, and in the second book, I named more names, real names, than I did in the first. So we'll see.
Yeah. And the reviews for both books have been quite good, haven't they?
Oh, this Always on Call was released on April 2nd, and it hit the BC bestsellers list number one on April 2nd. So it must have done it on pre-sales, right? Because you couldn't do that otherwise.
Yeah.
It was just knocked over almost. That seemed amazing. So, yeah, they've both done really well.
Yeah.
The readers have been wonderful.
Yeah. The book is called Always on Call, Adventures in Nursing, Ranching, and Rural Living. It's published by Heritage House. Also visit MarionCrookAuthor.com for more. Marion McKinnon Crook, join me on the line from Gibson's in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto. It's been such a pleasure to have read the book and to talk to you today, Mary, and I so appreciate your time. Congratulations and continued good luck with everything.
Thanks very much, Joe.